Our reading this morning is an article that appeared in The Atlantic entitled "The Power of Good Intentions" by Neil Wagner. Everyone seems to know that grandma's cookies taste better because they're made with love, and that phone calls to the cable company are less frustrating when there's a human being on the other end of the phone. But are these things really true? A University of Maryland psychologist devised a study that put them to the test. The result? Food tastes better, pain hurts less, and pleasure is more pleasant when they come with good intentions behind them. And it doesn't even matter if the intentions actually exist. It's the perception that they're there that's important. Seeing the world and the people in it as benevolent adds to life. Seeing them with a jaundiced eye can turn life into a bitter pill. The study involved three tests of pleasure, pain, and taste. In the first test, people sat in an easy chair with an electric massage pad that was either turned on by a real human being or a computer. The massages were identical, but people consistently got more pleasure from the massages where a human flipped the switch. The massages initiated by the computer just weren't viewed as good. The second test looked at candy. People were given packaged candy with a note attached on Valentine's Day. One note read, "I picked this just for you. Hope it makes you happy." A second note read, "Whatever." I forgot that it said this. A second note read, "Whatever, I don't care. I just picked it randomly." According to the study subjects, the candy that came with the Valentine tasted better and sweeter than the candy that came with the sulky message. A third test looked at pain and involved three groups who received electric shocks from a partner. Group one, the accidental group, thought they were being shocked without their partner's awareness. Group two thought their partner was shocking them maliciously. And group three, the benevolent group, thought their partner was shocking them for their own good in an effort to help them win money. People in group three, the benevolent group, reported much less pain from the shocks than people in the other groups did. Just the thought that the shocks had good intentions behind them made them hurt less. Three simple experiments that show how good intentions can add to life. There are a host of messages in this finding. One suggests that medical personnel should brush up on their bedside manner. Their poking, probing, and injections will hurt a lot less. Another is that being good to your relationship partner isn't good enough. They have to know that you mean it and really want them to feel good. The general message is that being suspicious leads to a very unhappy life. Trusting in people's good intentions makes for a happier one. This doesn't mean that you should give away the house, but constantly seeing hidden agendas will take its toll. You'll be much better off giving people the benefit of the doubt. Cynics might consider this a triumph of style over substance, and maybe they're right, but being right rarely makes life sweeter. Good intentions will. Here ends the reading.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I am so glad that Jim asked me to speak with today with you. And I have to tell you, your sanctuary is beautiful. I did attend this congregation once before, long ago, before the renovation, so I know the transformation that took place. It is stunning. While I was ordained over 7 years ago, I still think of myself as a relatively new Unitarian Universalist minister. And as Megan mentioned, my first experience in professional ministry was as a chaplain, where I completed a year-long residency program at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta. Serving as the chaplain for the maternity center and neonatal intensive care unit was a profound experience for me. It helped me realize that accompanying others during their times of difficulty might just be the most important part of my ministry. As one of five resident chaplains at Emory Hospital, one of the things that each of us had to do every week was take an overnight shift. That meant arriving at the hospital at 8:30 in the morning one day and not going home until 12 noon on the following day. Working the overnight shift meant that you were the only chaplain in a very large hospital. And it also meant that you would be called to offer pastoral care in any situation. Well, each chaplain wore a pager, and the head nurse on each floor knew to page the chaplain on overnight duty if we were needed. If things were relatively quiet during an overnight shift, we were encouraged to try and get some sleep. Well, Emory had graciously provided us with our very own bedroom in the hospital. Well, unfortunately, our very own bedroom also had very thin walls, and it was located directly across from the only 24-hour snack room in the hospital for patients, guests, and staff. Well, on those nights when I finished my rounds, I would go to the chaplain's bedroom and attempt to get a few hours of rest, only to be awakened by the sound of quarters clinking their way through a vending machine coin slot or an aluminum can of Diet Coke clunking its way down the dispenser chute. While this might seem like a minor thing, this vending machine activity went on all night long. So even though Emory offered us a generous bedroom, sleeping was really out of the question. Well, bone-tired one day after a long night, I mentioned this dilemma to one of my fellow chaplains, who laughed and said, "Terry, you haven't discovered the other bedrooms yet?" What other bedrooms? He proceeded to tell me about the wing of sleeping rooms on the other side of the hospital, which were used by the resident physicians. "Just get there early and reserve your room," he advised. "They go fast." Well, so on my next overnight, I went to the designated area and I found an entire suite of small bedrooms waiting for use. I did what my colleagues suggested. I made a paper sign that said "Reserved for Chaplain," and I taped it to the outside of one of the doors. Well, finally, if there were no overnight emergencies, I might be able to get some rest. And so after my rounds that evening, I proceeded to go to my reserved little pod on the 11th floor, and I settled in for what I hope might be my first few hours of uninterrupted sleep on a night shift. Well, it was, and I was delighted. Well, early the next morning, I got up rested and grateful and dressed for my 6 a.m. rounds. As I opened the door to my room, I noticed that my "Reserved for Chaplain" sign had been replaced by a folded piece of paper taped to the door. I opened the paper and read a letter that went something like this. "Dear Chaplain, I imagine you are getting a good night's sleep right now in a room that is clearly reserved for resident physicians only. If you had not taken this last available room, I would not have had to spend the night sitting upright in a wing chair in the hospital library trying to get some rest after a brutal day. Please use your own bedroom from now on. Thanks for your consideration. Sincerely, a very tired doctor." Well, needless to say, I was mortified. I hadn't intended to deprive a young resident of his or her rest. I had only intended to get a few winks myself. Nor did I realize that this wing of the hospital was off limits to anyone but physicians, something my chaplaincy supervisor confirmed with all the resident chaplains later that week when someone called and reported my violation. Well, while my intentions may have been considered good and completely understandable, My actions clearly resulted in some unintended, painful consequences. For me, this was a memorable example of the power of good intentions, their power to do good, and their power to do harm, whether we meant to or not. It's my understanding that Reverend Jim has been exploring with you in his sermons this month the importance of good intentions, of forming them, and of striving to keep them even during trying times. I know from my own experience that having good intentions can be the easy part. Following through on them when life events or my own entrenched human behavior seems to be stubbornly resisting change, on the other hand, can be very challenging. Studies have proven, for instance, that the good intentions behind New Year's resolutions usually don't get very far. Not because people don't really want to lose weight or stop smoking or clean out that cluttered garage once and for all, but simply because ingrained actions or ingrained non-actions can create a mountain of resistance. It can be downright painful for me to change a long-time behavior, even if I know that it's in my best long-term interest to do so. Consequently, some of my best intentions get stuck in first gear. The proverb, "The road to hell is paved with good intentions," suggests that good intentions without corresponding good actions are useless and even harmful. But I imagine many of us still have faith in our good intentions because we recognize that they are the powerful seeds through which significant changes can take hold and grow. So, what moves us from intention to action? How can we sustain our aspirations when the action required is challenging or positive outcomes seem elusive? These are the questions that I'd like to explore with you this morning. To begin, I'd like for us to consider the message in today's reading, that good intentions have the power to transform what might have been an ordinary or even painful experience into something positive and even extraordinary. Writer Neil Wagner asserts, and now research confirms, that cookies do taste better, pain does hurt less, and pleasure is more pleasant when they come with good intentions behind them. He writes, "Seeing the world and people in it as benevolent adds to life. Seeing them with a jaundiced eye can turn life into a bitter pill." The general message is that being suspicious leads to a very unhappy life. Trusting in people's good intentions makes for a happier one. In other words, it helps to remember that I may not have all the facts about a situation, including knowing what was in the other person's head or heart when he or she made the decision they made or took the action that they took. And so it's best not to assume the worst. Assuming the good intentions of others in every circumstance may seem like a rather naive approach to life, particularly given what's happening in our country and our world today. We might argue that some people, by their past words and actions, don't deserve the benefit of us assigning them good intentions. Well, this may be true in cases where our trust has been chronically or harmfully breached by another. But, as the reading suggests, assigning others good intentions isn't really for their benefit. It's for our benefit. Assuming good intentions, I believe, adds more faith to our lives. It lessens our suffering. It opens our hearts to the best in all people. It adds light to our lives and makes it more possible for us to bring light to dark places. I once heard it suggested that if there's someone in my life that is really getting under my skin, and I imagine I'm not the only one that has somebody in their life that really gets under their skin, I can pray for that person. I can pray that the person receive all the good things that I would like for myself, such as good health, peace of mind, happiness, and friendships. I can pray for them, whether I know them or not, whether I even believe in the power of prayer or not, or whether or not I mean one word of what I'm saying. How about that? The idea is that over time, my spiritual practice may not change the other person, but it will liberate me. In other words, my intentional daily prayers, or if you'd like, good wishes for the other person will release my anger and resentment. I've tried this, and when I've been willing to stick to it, and that's the catch, being willing to stick to it, when I've been willing to stick to it, it has worked. So, assuming that we might try to treat others as good-intentioned people, what about ourselves? What about our own good intentions? How might we sustain our own aspirations to be better spouses, better parents, better employees, and better activists when the action required is challenging or positive outcomes seem elusive? Well, I believe that one answer lies in one of my favorite readings in our gray hymnal. It's number 457, and if you would, I'd love it if you'd grab your gray hymnal and turn to number 457. It was written by 19th century Unitarian minister Reverend Edward Everett Hale, number 457. And I was going to read it by myself, but I wondered if you would join me in reading number 457. Ready? I am only one, but still I am one. I cannot do everything, but still I can do something. And because I cannot do everything, I will not refuse to do something that I can do. I just love that reading. Reverend Hale's words remind me that when I'm committed to doing the something, the one small thing that I can do, I ultimately avoid swamping my good intentions with unrealistic expectations. By doing the something that I can do, little by little, I believe that goals that once felt challenging or even impossible to achieve may feel a little less so. My guess is that we all have at least one example in our lives that we can point to that illustrates this. I imagine that the big accomplishments we've experienced in our lives, such as successful marriages, launched children, the completion of a significant personal or professional project, began first as a good intention. And then slowly over time, perhaps with two steps forward and one step back, our good intentions were brought into reality by doing precisely what Reverend Hale suggests, which it was to not refuse to do the daily somethings that we could do. For myself, if I desire to be a person who lives in faith and by faith, then for me, there really is no other way to live. I believe that I'll either succeed at my original good intention, or in failing to do so, I'll unexpectedly uncover something that adds to the quality of my character and my life. So, As we go from here, my hope for you and for me is that we won't underestimate the power of our intentions to create good and also to create harm. Where harm is an unintended consequence of our intentions, may we be able to forgive ourselves and make amends to others in our words and in our deeds. Where good is possible, may we not be afraid of thinking big or worried that our human limitations will make our journey difficult. Rather, may we loosen our grip on what we think is right, and may we keep an open mind about where we think our good intentions can or should take us. Then, as Reverend Edward Everett Hale recommends, and without pressure or fear, may we do the something that we know we can do, trust that our small actions, one day at a time, will then take us where we need to go. May it be so. Amen.